Get started. I'd like to welcome you all out tonight to the Northern Regional Advisory Council meeting. If you join me in turning off your cell phones or turning the volume down on them, we could try to have a nice uninterrupted meeting. My name's Robert Burns. I represent the public at large, and I'm the chairman of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. We'll go around and we'll have introductions, and I think we'll go backwards this time, so we'll start over here.
Justin Doling, I'm the regional supervisor, and I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
Paul Cowley, I represent the Forest Service.
Anna Ville, represent non-consumptive.
Bryce Thurgood, Perry, Utah, at large.
Russ Lawrence, Mogan, Utah, public at large.
Lynn Nelson, elected.
R. Jeffrey Hicks, at large.
John Blazard, representing agriculture.
Craig Van Tassel, sportsman.
John Wall from Riverdale, at large.
Jim Gaskell from South Weber, still at large.
Still at large.
Still?
You caught me yet.
Our purpose here tonight is to hear presentations on wildlife regulations in Utah. We'll make a recommendation to the Wildlife Board, and they'll set policy. I did forget to recognize Ernie Perkins, representing the Northern Region on the Wildlife Board. Our procedure will be, we'll have a presentation from the division, then we'll have questions on that presentation from the public, then we'll go to the council with questions, then we'll go back to the public for comments. If you want to make a comment, please fill out a blue card and then I can call you up. After comments from the public, we'll go to the council for deliberations and motions on the agenda item. When you're commenting, if you're representing a group, we'll give you 5 minutes. Paul will be timing you. He'll try to give you an idea if you're getting short on time. If you're representing yourself, you'll get three minutes. Other than that, I think we're good. We haven't had any changes to the agenda. Would anyone like to make a motion to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting?
So moved.
I have a motion from Lynn and a second from Ann to approve the agenda. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Hopefully you all received the minutes I sent out. There were some small changes I made, mostly for so you could understand, or someone reading it could understand. Are there any additional amendments to the minutes? John.
In the minutes, and I didn't run those off so that I could tell you exactly where it was, but it's talking about the extra, I believe the extra cow out tags that were issued.
Okay. Probably when Justin was speaking.
Yeah, it doesn't mention the fact that they were elk, it just says extra tags.
Okay. So change that to cow elk.
Just so that, yeah, so okay. Sometime down the road when somebody reads that, they can see that it means cow elk.
And we weren't hunting domestic cows.
Well, whatever, yeah.
Any additional changes? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion.
Move that we accept the minutes of the previous meeting as amended.
Second.
We have a motion from Jim and a second from Paul to approve the amended minutes of the previous meeting. I'm not sure exactly what the date was now either.
The 12th of September, I believe.
9-12-12, okay. All in favor, say aye, please.
Aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous? Okay. We'll go now to the regional update.
Okay, I'd like to just start out this evening and bring you up to speed on some personnel changes here in the region. Brad Hunt is our new hardware ranch manager. He started, I believe, about a week and a half ago. He's been transitioning between his old job and new job, so we're glad to have Brad aboard. Adam Brewerton is our new sensitive species biologist, and Corey Wallace is our new assistant wildlife specialist, excuse me. And then Amy Vandervoort here in the room, would you hold your hand up, Amy? She's our new biologist, and Morgan Southridge, wildlife biologist. And then Craig Skalgard, who was our aquatic manager, is now promoted into Salt Lake, and we're in the process of trying to refill behind Craig. So those are the personnel changes. A little bit of an update in the wildlife section. The swans have really started to move in pretty thick on the Great Salt Lake. Good numbers of swans, so if you have a swan permit, now's the time to get out and try to pursue one of those. The biologists are going through their postseason deer classifications. And I would encourage any RAC member that wants to get out with the biologist and help him do those classifications to either contact Darren or Randy or contact the biologist directly. Those are kind of fun counts and get you out in the field and see what kind of bucks are out there. A little bit of an update on the duck hunt. The duck hunt started out really well here in the region. It went through a little bit of a lull. I'm told that the last storm front pushed out more birds than we actually received, so we're in a little bit of a lull on the duck hunt, but the swans have arrived, so that kind of makes up for it. Darren DeBlois, our assistant wildlife manager, is looking for volunteer help on our rebuilding our elk trap, so if you've got anybody that in mind that would like to help Darren rebuild that trap, he can definitely use the help. A little bit of a recap on the deer hunt. Our deer hunt went very well this year. It was much improved from last year. We checked in more bucks through our check station, and the deer were in very, very good condition. Most people I talked to were very pleased with what they were seeing in the field. They were seeing a lot of bucks, a lot of deer in general. So I think in overall the deer hunt was quite a success this year. From our law enforcement section, I just want to go through some general facts. The first quarter of the year, which our year starts in July 1, in the first quarter of the year from July 1 to October 1st, our officers made 12,505 field contacts, checked 6,833 licenses, responded to 48 UTIP calls or help stop poaching calls, conducted 139 investigations, detected 145 violations, and issued 253 warning citations. In addition to that, our officers have been involved in an additional 393 investigations since January 1st. So our law enforcement section has been busy, and this is always a busy time for them during the hunts. Some of the activities they've got coming up is we're going to continue to do our winter range patrol, where they'll go out and look for illegal activity on the winter ranges. And again, you're welcome to join the officers for that. They'll be doing some waterfowl enforcement on the marshes adjacent to Great Salt Lake, working the swan hunt. And they wanted me to pass along their appreciation to Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife for funding a elk decoy, which they've used now on two occasions and have actually issued citations for folks shooting that decoy in areas they shouldn't be shooting or after hours. So they want to express appreciation to SFW for providing the resources to buy that decoy. In our fisheries section, the aquatics folks have been busy sampling Blacksmith's Fork stream. There's a new regulation on Blacksmith's Fork where they're going to try to increase the take out of that stretch of the Blacksmith's Fork from Hardware down to the mouth of the canyon with the intent to hopefully raise larger fish. So there's a four bonus limit on browns. So what they wanted to do is go out and collect some baseline data, and then as these new regulations go into effect, come back in a couple of years and see if it's had any influence on the size of the fish. They also have stocked Holmes Creek and Willard Creek with Bonneville cutthroat trout as part of the cutthroat restoration plan. And they tell me that the Weber River right now is fishing really well, and in addition, the Ogden River is fishing well. So if you like to fish rivers, those are two good places to go. Our habitat section has been busy reseeding and doing habitat work at our Millville WMA, Hardware Ranch WMA, and also Hennifer Echo WMA. They've also been working with the Bureau of Land Management on some of the fire rehab work out in West Box Elder. And then from our outreach section, Jody has been involved in organizing volunteer efforts here in the region, and for the first quarter of this year, we've had 3,785 hours of volunteer service, primarily through the Dedicated Hunter Program and other small volunteer activities. So thanks, Jody, for your efforts there. And with that, unless you have any questions, that completes my update. Oh, one last thing. Our coyote program, we've currently checked in 1,365 coyotes statewide and paid out $68,250. That program started in September.
Thank you, Justin. Anise, you're up.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always good to be in the Northern Region. It's kind of where I started my career, so it feels like home. Tonight I'm going to be presenting the 2013 Bucks Bowls Once in a Lifetime season dates and proclamation. We'll start with the deer hunt recommendations. Our 2013 general season deer hunt dates won't be very different than they were this year. Just they'll be switched basically one day to account for the calendar change. So our archery season will be August 17th through September 13th. The muzzleloader will be September 25th through October 3rd. And the any weapon season will be October 19th through the 27th. So not a whole lot of changes on that. And similar, these will be statewide dates. 9 days for the muzzleloader and any weapon, and 28 days for the archery. Moving to general season elk hunt dates, again, no major changes recommended, just basically one day different from last year, just accounting for the calendar. So the archery spike bull hunt will go from August 17th till September 6th. That hunt closes early because the spike hunt overlaps the limited entry hunt for elk. So this gives archers that have a limited entry tag to hunt at least the last 7 days of the hunt without interference from spike hunters, which is the part closest to the rut. That's the reason we did it towards the end and not in the beginning. So giving them 7 days assures that they'll at least get a weekend where they can hunt closest to the rut without having interference from spike hunters. The archery any bull hunt will go from August 17th through September 13th. That's the same as the deer hunt. The any weapon hunt will be October 5th through the 17th. The muzzleloader will be October 30th through November 7th. And then the youth any bull hunt will overlap the limited entry rifle hunt, and it's in September 14th through the 22nd. In the last few years, there has been a late youth any bull hunt that occurs only in the northeastern region in the Vernal subunit. That hunt is meant to deal with some bulls that are unavailable for harvest during the regular season and show up on public land late in the season. It's usually about 15 or so permits, so it's not a lot of opportunity, but it does provide youth with some opportunity to harvest bulls that are not available during the regular season. And that's a fairly long season just because it's hard to predict when those bulls will come off, you know, weather dependent and things like that. So we give those youth a 47-day season to be able to kind of find time and find the bulls where they end up. So that starts on November 30th and ends January 15th. Some of the recommended changes that will take effect statewide is basically one recommendation that we have is to allow youth to purchase unlimited over-the-counter general season archery deer permits. Now, this we had something similar to this 2 years ago, where we allowed youth archers to purchase. We had set aside 1,500 permits that were good for the archery hunt, we did that for 2 years. But when we went to unit by unit, it was hard to have those 1,500 translate. Because they were statewide permits, and now that we were going unit by unit, it was hard to, we didn't want to allocate them by unit. And the reason we went with unlimited is because when we did the 1,500, there were only really about 450 youth that actually took advantage of it. So we didn't feel that there was going to be a run on them if we went unlimited. And, our youth archers are going to be less effective at killing deer, so just allowing them to get out and hunt, we felt would be a good opportunity. And the reason there aren't so many that clamoring for these tags is that youth have a preference for drawing a tag in the drawing, because we do set aside 20% of the permits for youth. So any youth that didn't draw for some reason, maybe they put in for a hard unit, can have an opportunity to just go purchase one now. And that's kind of the reasoning behind making them unlimited. There's really not a need to limit them because we probably won't get a whole lot of people doing it. And if we find in the future that this does become, really popular and we're selling thousands and thousands and it starts affecting harvest, then we can start regulating them by unit if we need to. But we don't believe that it will be that prohibitive. Okay, I'll move into some region-based recommendations. Starting with the southern region, they're recommending changing the Fillmore Oak Creek South unit that is currently limited entry elk to an any bull unit. Most of you remember when we brought the unit plans through the rack and board process. That change was actually in those plans at that time, and it already passed. We're just basically codifying that through the RAC process again to make sure it gets into the proclamation and rule. So basically that Fillmore Oak Creek unit has never performed well as a limited entry unit. It doesn't have great elk habitat. Most of the elk end up, in crop areas. Most people that draw that unit are often, not thrilled after they go out there to hunt because there's a lot of private land. And it's kind of fits what we call an any bull unit, not what we call a limited entry unit. So that is why we're recommending turning that into an any bull unit. And similarly, there's a portion of the beaver unit that's west of Highway 15 that's very similar to the Oak Creek unit. It's about, the same proportion of private land. Habitat is fairly similar, so not great elk habitat, but elk do live there. And then by turning that into an any bull unit, it allows hunters to be able to, go out there and hunt if they gain access to private land and harvest some bulls. So this will split the beaver unit. So basically anything west of I-15 will become any bull, and then the rest of the unit will remain under limited entry. Again, this also was in the unit plan when they went through the process. They had a committee, and it went through the rack and board process as well. The southeastern region, basically, they went through a lot of their boundaries and made sure a lot of them aligned, because a lot of times we make boundaries for deer that don't really match up with elk or pronghorn, and we're urging all the regions to do this, but the southern region took the initiative this year and actually went through them fairly thoroughly. That's why there's a lot of modified boundaries on this. So basically, on the Henry Mountains, they're recommending modifying the deer, elk, and bighorn sheep boundaries and the San Rafael South pronghorn boundary. And basically, this is just to draw the boundary up against the Capitol Reef National Park. Currently, the boundary goes to a road that goes through the park, but it also says that it excludes the park. So instead of making it, you know, that distinction, we just made the boundary the park boundary. So that's the big change there. And then they're recommending modifying the Booklet bighorn sheep and pronghorn hunt boundaries to match the deer boundary. Again, just for consistency, it moves that boundary from the Green River about a quarter mile into a road that basically parallels the Green River. Modify the Booklet Bitter Creek South limited entry elk boundary to match the deer boundary. That's the same boundary change as the one above. Modify the 9 mile Ranch Creek boundary for pronghorn elk and bighorn sheep to match the Booklet. So once you change the Booklet, the 9 mile Ranch Creek has to change to match that. So these are all, fairly minor changes, but any boundary change we have to bring through the RACN board. Modify the LaSalle Mountains and San Juan elk unit boundaries to match general season deer. Last year there was a last minute change to the general season deer. There's a small portion between those two units that's really not great deer and elk habitat, but deer and elk do show up there occasionally. So they carved it out, they basically added it to the LaSalle and took it out of the San Juan, and then they wanted to make the elk match that. And then modify the LaSalle Potash Bighorn Sheep Unit and the LaSalle South Cisco Pronghorn Hunt boundaries so they're the same. Right now we hunt pronghorn and bighorn sheep on it, generally the same area, but they have different boundary description. This makes that whole area, that LaSalle Potash South Cisco Desert, one unit, and also uses the same name for both of those hunts. So both those hunts will now be called the LaSalle South Potash / South Cisco. So it's just for basically making hunt boundaries similar, so we're not having to have multiple boundaries for each species. Okay, moving to the northern region. The northern region is recommending changing the Pilot Mountain limited entry elk boundary to include some private land where depredation is occurring. This basically moves the boundary a little bit further to the east from where it currently is. It currently kind of hugs the bottom of the mountain. It moves it a little bit out into the flats where some private lands could use some harvest because of depredation issues. Add a premium limited entry elk hunt on the Cache Meadowvale unit to make it consistent statewide. In the past, the Meadowvale unit did not have a premium hunt, even though it had an early, late, and muzzleloader. A lot of units that don't, when we get below a certain number of permits, it really doesn't make sense to have a premium hunt, but the Meadowvale does currently have enough permits to allow for a premium hunt. And this keeps it consistent with all the other units in the state. Add a bighorn sheep hunt on the Pilot Mountain for 2013 per our agreement with Nevada. Basically, in the past, when we had enough sheep there, if there were enough permits to both hunt, then we both had a permit. But if there weren't enough, we alternated years. They had the tag last year on that unit. I think this year both sides are going to have a tag. Is that right, Jim? On 2013?
Yeah, 2013.
Yeah. Yeah, so there'll be one permit on both sides of the boundary, and they can hunt both the Nevada side and the Utah side. That sheep population is not doing great. We had a die-off go through that a couple years ago, but there are, from our surveys, a number of rams still available on that unit for harvest. So instead of, you know, watching them die from disease, it probably is a good idea to go ahead and have a hunt and harvest those rams. Recommending allow harvest of either sex on the Ogden Extended Archery deer unit to be consistent statewide. Currently, the Wasatch Front allows harvest of either sex. This is just for consistency's sake to make it similar with that. The reason for that hunt is to try to reduce the number of of deer on the front and amongst the houses, so it makes sense to go ahead and harvest either sex on that. And then the last one in the northern region is to clarify the boundary description to inform hunters of the posted area around the meadow at Hardware Ranch. So what we'll do is we'll put something in the proclamation that you know, the area around the meadow is closed. Please, and it won't have a description, but it'll say it will be posted. So what will happen is that we'll have to make sure it's posted. And in the past, it hasn't been in the proclamation, so we want to make sure that hunters are aware that the area around the meadow is actually close to hunting. It's kind of been always posted, and people that hunt that area know it, you know, from being a biologist there, but I think it is a good step to actually put it in the boundary description. Okay, moving to the central region, recommended changes. They're recommending adding a late any weapon limited entry elk hunt on the Wasatch, Nebo, and Deep Creek units to reduce crowding. In the past on those units, there's a few units in the state where we have an early elk hunt but don't have a late, and these are these three are amongst those. The reason we did it on these units is that when we originally had the hunt, success rates for the late hunt weren't very much different than the early hunt, so we really didn't see the need. And at that time, we didn't have very many permits on those units, so we didn't see the need to have two separate hunts if success rate was similar. Now that we're, you know, issuing more than 300 permits on the Wasatch and, you know, quite a few on the Nebo, we're recommending adding that late hunt basically to distribute hunters more than anything else. I don't think it'll affect harvest a whole lot, and if it does, we can regulate numbers to deal with that. So this is not to get more hunting opportunity, but basically to spread out hunters that currently hunt that unit. And then the second recommendation is add a premium limited entry elk hunt on the Deep Creek unit. Again, that's another one that can have a premium limited entry elk hunt, but does not. And for those who don't know, a premium limited entry elk hunt means you can hunt all the season dates. It's not a special, like, hunt that's on a special unit. It's on the regular limited entry elk units, but it allows you to hunt all the season. So you can hunt archery, both rifle hunts and muzzleloader. And then recommending adding a mountain goat hunt on a Nebo unit. That unit currently just started having enough goats on it basically to have a hunt. They flew the unit this past year and were counted 50 total goats, which you know, with the number of billies on there, does qualify it for a hunt. About 25 of those are actually on Mount Nebo, and about 25 are on the are low for WMA, so they're kind of split. But those are where the ones that were seen, so there's obviously more goats than that on the unit. And then they're recommending discontinuing the late doe only hunt on the Wasatch Front Extended Archery Area to be consistent with the Ogden area. So right now they can take either sex up till the end of December, but then they have a December 1st through the 15th hunt where it's doe only. They're basically removing that and just ending the hunt at the same time as the Ogden unit for consistency. Okay, switching gears a little bit. These are some of the key dates that'll be in our rule. Big game drawing for bucks and bulls once in a lifetime and new dedicated hunter applicants will be February 1st through March 4th. There is an application period for those who just want to buy a preference point or a bonus point and want to withdraw. So basically, it's the same period, but it's extended to March 11th. And then the results of the drawing should be posted by May 31st in 2013. Lifetime license questionnaire, unit selection deadline. Basically, the way this works is lifetime license holder will automatically be assigned the unit they had the previous year unless they send in one of these questionnaires. And the questionnaire, if they do decide to send one in, must be received by March 4th, 2013. Those that didn't hunt in 2012 and failed to send a questionnaire in We'll basically have to wait and see what permits are left over after the drawing and then be able to get those. Shed antler and shed horn season dates. The online course and completion certificate is required if you're going to pick up shed antlers and horns from February 1st through April 15th. If you go outside of those dates, there is no requirement. Dates where hunters may purchase or sell big game or its parts. Antlers, heads, horns of legally taken big games may be bought or sold February 15th through July 31st. Basically, this is outside the hunting season to basically not make people go out and shoot one, sell it, and so on and so forth. That's the rationale for the season dates on those. And then untanned hides for legally taken big game may be bought and sold August 1st through February 14th. Now, that one is basically the inverse, because if you have an untanned hide, you basically are selling it when you've harvested the animals. So it is actually during the actual season. So that's why the antlers is different than the hides taken. Okay, some dates for general season extension for disabled hunters. Basically, the reason we do this is disabled hunters have a little bit of extension. Sometimes it's before the season, sometimes it's after the season. So that, because they do have a disadvantage, it gives them an opportunity to harvest on those hunts. For archery deer, it is a preseason, so they start August 12th and can hunt through the season. But basically, the preseason extension ends on the 16th of August. Muzzleloader, September 20th through the 24th, also a preseason extension. The any weapon deer is October 14th through the 18th, also a preseason extension. The archery elk, August 12th through the 16th, same as the deer. The muzzleloader bull elk, November 8th through the 13th. And the any weapon bull elk is September 14th through the 22nd. And they can also hunt that late youth hunt dates as well. They're in that area specifically. Muzzleloader spike elk hunt is a postseason extension, November 11th through the 15th, and then the any weapon spike elk hunt October 18th through the 22nd. That's my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Anise. Are there any questions from the public on Anise's presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on Anise's presentation. Jeff.
I have a question about the bighorns in the Pilot Mountains.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty interesting when you're talking about they're, I guess, having a tough time up there with disease or something.
Yeah.
So Utah, Nevada each gets a permit, and you mentioned that might as well take some if they're going to die anyway.
Right.
Are they all going to die? And do you anticipate them dying? And if so, why not just give a whole bunch of permits and clean them out?
Right. There's a couple of thought processes that go through mine. It's not if they come in contact with diseased animals, they will die. This group of rams has managed to, remain isolated, obviously, and haven't gotten disease. We don't want to over-harvest them if they're not, going to die imminently. There's not a lot of production, but there are mature rams. So we're just targeting those mature rams on a year-by-year basis. So the way we set our permits is we do it on a percent of counted rams. So if there are, it's either 12% of total rams or 30% of class 3 and 4 rams. And that's kind of what the number comes out to, is we can harvest about 2 animals. If we issue more permits, they will have to kill younger rams, which we would rather see them grow up and provide opportunity for once-in-a-lifetime hunt that way. So we'll obviously it's hard to say whether they're going to die for sure, but we have had a die-off there, and production isn't good. So we'll have probably a good hunt for the next few years if these rams don't die. But, we don't want to hurry them there either, because we're not sure that they will die. It just matters whether they come in contact with the other sheep or not.
Can you just tell me what's killing them?
Yeah. So, you know, that's really complicated, but I'll boil it down. Bighorn sheep are susceptible to several strains of pneumonia that are carried by domestic sheep. And although in rare instances they can build up immunity, they don't do it quick enough to overcome the initial rush of it. And that area there is kind of one that does well for a while, and then they come in contact with domestics, because they run a lot of domestics in that area.
Okay.
And then once they come in contact with domestics, it's usually when populations expands, they come in contact. And then you have a die-off go through the population, and then kind of the cycle starts over again. It's unfortunate. They can overcome it if adults are able to stay alive long enough for the immunity to build up. And usually takes about 10 years for them to do that. So you have to have adults staying alive, usually very low reproduction, because the young succumb to it almost immediately. So it's unfortunate. But that's likely what took out most of the bighorns in the West, is when, you know, we introduced domestic sheep and goats to the area. But it's a very tricky thing, because we're trying to reintroduce sheep as many places as we can, yet we're trying to keep them segregated from coming in contact with domestic sheep.
How do you do that?
We just put them in places where we know there's no sheep allotments. And then, you know, when populations get to a certain size, we either transplant them or with harvest try to reduce them. Right now, we haven't had to do them with harvest yet. We've been able to move them around enough, but it's getting to the point where eventually we'll have to harvest some ewes.
So the sheep herds are staying relatively stable up there? I mean, so the sheep would always stay in the same, but the bighorns expand into their range.
Yeah,
and back out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, that's
all. So when populations of bighorn increase, then they start making forays into areas and coming in contact with domestics more often. Yeah, Jim's the biologist for that area. I'll give him an opportunity to give you a little bit more detail.
With this specific population...
Jim, give us your name.
Jim Christensen, Box Elder Unit 1 District Biologist. With this specific population, the animals that we are seeing are actually on Pilot Mountain itself, congregated around some guzzlers that Nevada has put in, and then the springs down on the TL Bar Ranch. The animals that have been infected and been getting sick there further south on the Lepe Hills, and they will periodically go down into Wendover. They'll be seen on the golf course in Wendover. There's one water treatment plant there that spills water out where they will water. You know, they'll come in contact with domestics down around Wendover, come up into that water source, and that's where the main disease has been affecting them. And there's just the geographic separation based off water placement that is keeping the actual pilot mountain herd healthy for now. But, you know, they could come back and forth with population expansion. So that's typically what's been happening.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate that. Does that make it clear?
All right. Let me get Bryce. Bryce? Oh, you're good. Go ahead, Paul.
So on the archery deer tags, if we're going to open it unlimited for youth, is there any reason to set aside 20%?
Yeah, so these permits will be available after the drawing for any youth that didn't draw. So, yeah, I think we need to, because not all youth are going to want to hunt archery. So we're going to give them the opportunity to put in for rifle, muzzleloader, and maybe even archery during the drawing. Maybe they want to, you know, hunt a unit that's some units for archery will be hard to draw. So, and then if they don't draw that, then they have the opportunity to do that after the drawing.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Jim.
So I still don't understand, if it's unlimited, why would they bother to put in? They'll just wait and get one afterwards.
Yeah, and they certainly could do that, unless they want to hunt with rifle or muzzleloader, or if they want to hunt all three seasons, they can put in for rifle and do that. So there will be an incentive for most youth don't archery hunt, unless, you know, they come from a family that archery hunts. So,
but if they're archery hunters,
they're right. Oh, yeah, they can certainly wait and get a permit for whatever unit they want. Yeah,
yeah. And it'll be, it won't be statewide, it'll be a specific unit.
Yeah, they have
unit.
To pick a specific unit.
Yeah,
yes,
okay.
Correct. No, it's not statewide.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly could do that, you know, but, yeah, we'll kind of have to wait and see how that plays out. If they do that, that may actually... more youth may be able to draw through the drawing than have currently.
Sure, it should open up some tags for the drawing kids.
Yeah.
Anise, on the Pilot Mountain elk boundary change, will people drawing those tags be able to hunt on that private land? Are they going to let them get down on that private land or not?
No, I'll let Jim cover that as well.
Jim Christensen, Box Elder District Biologist. They will be able to hunt down there. Part of the damage that they get, in order for them to get a payment from us, they have to allow public access to hunt those elk.
Great. And then one other question on the sheep, on some of the boundary changes on sheep. Lockhart overlaps the San Juan and the La Salle unit, but you didn't change it. There's no change recommended on that. It isn't a problem because it's a little smaller unit, but there's a lot of area south of Lockhart in the San Juan unit that could be included if that was increased.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, I'm not super familiar with that area, so... you know, having none of the regional biologists there, I'll write a note down and find out for you, and I can get back with you as far as that goes.
It's just, if you're standardizing them,
it
does overlap, but Lockhart is a little smaller unit to start with. So.
So the Lockhart overlaps with which one, the potash? Or?
It overlaps into the LaSalle deer unit.
LaSalle deer, I see.
You're kind of going across two
general
season unit boundaries that you're talking about trying to standardize on.
Yeah, I guess my thought on that is because it is a small unit, they want to be able to harvest those sheep individually rather than opening up the whole LaSalle sheep unit as one unit.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'll certainly bring it up to those guys.
Jim, did you have another question?
Well, kind of along the same lines, I'm just wondering this is strictly administrative boundary changes, and do you take into consideration that a deer herd and a bighorn sheep herd aren't necessarily geographically the same?
Right. I think they took that into consideration and tried to include both if they were going to make it standard. Yeah.
So there'll be a bunch of non-good deer habitat and non-good bighorn sheep habitat, but that's okay.
Yeah, that is, yeah.
I mean, they just won't hunt whether they're on the elk or deer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the considerations for where animal movements are taken into consideration when making those boundaries.
Any additional questions?
And they're minor changes. If you look at them on a map,
that wasn't really, just wanted to bring that up.
John?
On the late weapon, any weapon, elk hunts on Wasatch, you're talking about having two separate seasons, but you're not going to increase the number of permits?
Well, we don't know what the permits will be. They may or may not increase depending on how the ages come back for the harvest. So if they do increase, you know, we'll have two hunts to split them among. But if they stay the same, again, we'll split them amongst two hunts.
Okay. So that would reduce pressure.
Yeah, well, it'll reduce crowding. Yeah. I mean, I think harvest is not going to change a whole lot just because, you know, they're about equally vulnerable during the rut or in the late season on that unit just because where they winter and things like that.
Okay.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to comments from the public. I have one card, and this is going to be Winsendell, which I've sent you out his email on his muzzleloader pronghorn proposal, and we're going to give him 5 minutes to talk about it. Go ahead, Wynn.
My name is Wynn Zundel, and I thank Mr. Burns and the council for entertaining me with my proposal. For the audience and those that are not in the loop, basically my proposal is to make a statewide available muzzleloader hunt for pronghorn in Utah. Utah has over 15,000 muzzleloaders, and it's my belief that with my little group of muzzleloader enthusiasts that I pal around with, there's a lot of talk about our ability to hunt antelope using our muzzleloaders. I had a discussion with Ernie a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, Wynn, there's no reason that a person couldn't obtain any weapon antelope permit and use his muzzleloader to harvest that animal. And I told him, I said, you know, Ernie, that's true, and we're all very well aware of that, but some of us would rather wear our buckskin outfits than blaze orange to gain that. And that's where I'm coming from with this whole thing. I'm going to be real brief, but I'd like to read this last statement on my paper here so that I don't mess it up. I said, I'd like to ask the council for a motion to recommend to the Utah Wildlife Board that they establish an action log item for the division to investigate additional muzzleloader pronghorn hunting opportunities in the state. That's all I have, and I thank you again.
Thank you, Wynn. Anise, do you want to just comment briefly on his proposal?
Sure. And I've been corresponding by email with him. Basically, you know, we're not opposed to it. The only reason we haven't done it is there are very few units, pronghorn units in the state where we have enough permits that you can split them three ways and not affect drawing odds and things like that. So there may be a handful of units where we could do this on. If we do it across the board, you know, there could be some ramification for drawing odds, non-resident permits, all of those things that kind of devil is in the detail type of things. And if you can see, if you look at the number of hunts that are any weapon and number that are archery, those differ even because there's not enough permits to even have an archery hunt on some of these units. So that's kind of the rationale. And the reason we did it for the plateau was where we were getting to a point where hunter crowding was going to be an issue, and we figured we could add a weapon hunt and move some hunters into that. So I don't see it as a problem to do it if we look into it and do it right on the units where we have enough permits to do that. To do it across the board may be problematic on some units just because of the, you know, our pronghorn herd units sometimes are fairly small. We don't have a lot of them. On units where we have a lot, I think it would be very doable.
And so an action log request from the Wildlife Board would incorporate all those different people in the division that would be looking at the licensing and the drawing odds and everything.
That's correct, yeah. Okay. I mean, that would be the best way to approach it, is give us at least a year to look at it and figure out a best way to do it.
Okay. We can probably go right to comments here in a second if you want, Jim, because that's the only one I have.
I can do it in comments, or I can do it as a question now. It doesn't matter to me.
Do we have anyone else that would like to comment on the Bucks and Bulls agenda topic? Okay, seeing none, we'll just go into council comments. So go ahead, Jim.
Are we then investigating and studying these things that Mr. Zundel is interested in now, or do we really need to ask you to do it?
Well,
is it something you're already doing?
It would be nice to have it in a formal way, yeah. I mean, we look at it. I mean, right now, there's nothing burning to make us change, because there's really not a need for it. To be honest, you know, very few people put in for the muzzleloader only, and draw odds are pretty good still. Again, it's not going to be added opportunity. It's just going to be splitting the pie differently. So
it's just going to wake up another dog for you.
Yeah. So that's kind of, yeah, that's what it is. So okay. For us, it's not a burning issue. We weren't looking in making this change, but if we're asked to by the Wildlife Board to look at it, it'll give our biologists that much more of an incentive to look at which units they think it could be doable and which units they're not.
And that much more work for them.
Well, you know, the work's work. We all got to do it. So,
not if we're retired.
Yeah. Now you're doing something, I agree. I guarantee it. You know, for example, like the San Rafael Desert pronghorn hunt, we discontinued that this year because there weren't enough permits. We left it in the rifle, but discontinued the archery. So there's a lot of those type of hunts that probably wouldn't be able to put a muzzleloader and a rifle and an archery hunt on. So those are the intricacies that we need to work out.
Additional comments from the council? Bryce.
I personally like the idea. I mean, we do it for the deer and we do it for the elk, you know, and obviously the antelope. And I'd personally like to thank him for coming and coming up with the idea and coming to the meeting and presenting it, because I'm kind of in support of it, so at least experimenting with it.
Jeffrey.
Yeah, I'm kind of along the same lines. So we have, looking at all the different seasons and the splits and the this is this for this and 28 days for this and 10 days for this, and what's another thing to split out? Especially, you know, it's just, I think he's just asking for them to investigate the possibilities. Am I correct here? So
yeah,
why not?
Okay.
Is this a good time to make a motion to accept it?
Move on? If we're done commenting, we go ahead and start with our motions and get through
okay.
it.
Okay. I'd make a motion we accept Mr. Zundel, right? Zundel? Okay, make sure I do it right. His request to have it investigated.
So?
By the Wildlife Board.
Second.
Okay. Let me just rephrase it, if you would.
You're good at that.
My purpose.
That's why you're the chair.
You would, your motion would be to recommend the Wildlife Board establish an action log item to study the opportunities for muzzleloader pronghorn hunting, additional muzzleloader pronghorn hunting.
That's good.
Acceptable. Okay.
Second.
Okay. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hands. Looks like unanimous. Okay, now the remainder. Would someone, Bryce?
I can make a motion that we accept the presentation as presented.
Second.
Discussion on the motion.
I just have one item that I don't know whether I really ought to say it or not, but I'm concerned about a number of days that archery hunters have. They have almost a month to be out in the bush chasing and harassing and flinging arrows and wounding animals, and I'm thinking that with the equipment and the technology that archery hunters have today, it seems to me that and I speak of this from experience of the time that I spend all my summers on the mountain, and I sure find a lot of wounded and dead deer during the archery hunt. And so I think, as we think about, you know, whether the mountain lions are killing our deer or where the deer are going, I think we need to think about that. And I just wonder if it's time that we take a look at how much time the archery hunters actually have to be able to harvest their animals. Because I've seen deer on my private hay fields, that good bucks that are walking around on three legs, because probably somebody took a 70-yard loblolly shot at one. I just think with the archery equipment that we have nowadays and the range finders and all of the things that we have, it seems to me that the bona fide, really good archery hunters ought to be able to harvest a deer in a couple of weeks. And it would sure give the animals a little bit of a reprieve if they had a week off from the chase that starts the middle of August and ends the middle of November. That's That's my two bits worth. I just couldn't resist, but I had to say it. So.
And in the past, we've had a lot of pressure from archery hunters for a long season.
Right. I understand.
And a lot of times they don't want to start real early because of the heat. And if they knew we were going to talk about it, they'd be here to talk to us tonight.
I'm sure they would, but where we're setting the season dates, I just thought that I'd like to throw that out for
okay.
I'll just make a comment on that.
Sure, Russ.
You know, the equipment may be better, but, you know, good equipment in people's hands that don't practice and have bad ethics isn't going to matter at all.
That's right. So.
Jeffrey?
Okay, I'm going to make another comment on this, too. If we're out of line on this topic, just to stop me. But so why is it that bow hunters have so long? Is it because of the reduced rate of success, or is it because they like to be out there for a long time?
It is because of the reduced success. I mean, with 28 days, their harvest success is half of that of rifle or muzzle loaders. So they're not harvesting as many deer. And we always get the argument of the wounding loss, but and that's probably more of an ethical issue than it is a logistic or legal issue, because there are now rifles that are shooting thousands of yards, and if you wound something at that distance, you don't know whether you did or not. So, you know, I guess there's arguments to be made on all sides of it. This has been hashed over and over again, and what tells you how many bucks you have after the season is when we do our classifications. And with our current system, you know, the archers are taking theirs, rifle hunters are taking theirs, and muzzleloaders are taking theirs, and then we still have a sufficient number postseason for getting started again. And so that's kind of how we gauge things. To without any data or information, we can't really say that they're wounding too many or more than muzzle loaders and rifles or anything like that. So I hate to penalize one group of hunters for what you may have seen might have been, you know, an unethical hunter that may have taken a lob shot or whatever. But those exist in every weapon type, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I hate to just penalize one group for that. Yeah, I agree. They do have a long season, but their hunt success is half of, even with those 28 days, they harvest half of what muzzleloaders and light rifle hunters harvest. So, but this venue is for that, for such a comment, and I appreciate you making it, and we hear it on both sides, believe me, sure.
Paul?
So, Anise, do you think the harvest would change significantly if that was dropped to a two-week season versus the four?
It may.
I mean, is it similar to the other hunts that most of the harvest takes place in the first week?
No, it's not. It is a little more drawn out. And plus, they hunt, even on a 28-day season, they hunt an average of 9 days. So it just gives them, you know, more chances to get out, and so they're not hunting all 28 days. Very few hunters do, but it's just, you know, I guess if we shortened it, they would probably hunt, you know, if it was a two-week hunt, they may hunt, you know, 6 or 7 days.
In the 2 weeks.
I don't think success rate would drop a whole lot, nor would wounding loss, because they may feel more rushed to take a shot or whatever. So, you know, it's kind of, you don't know where to find the balance. It's one of those things where there's good arguments on both sides of the story. So we kind of say this is the way it is, and if we see that much comment come to change it and it goes through the process, we're not opposed to shortening the season. But usually it comes out about even, or with the archers maybe making a little bit better of an argument. So,
thank you.
Jim?
They're certainly a lot better organized than any other group. If you want a real answer as to why we have a long season, it has a lot to do with who comes in here and talks to us.
Right.
We wouldn't have brought up Mr. Zundel's topic if he hadn't been here. And so if you want to make a change, you organize, get a, get get a group of anti-bow hunters in here and something might happen, but maybe not.
Maybe not. I appreciate that comment.
Craig.
What's the trend with success in archery hunting? Are there any trends with a...
It's fairly stable. It varies from year to year depending on conditions, but it's usually right around 15 to 18% success rate, and it's held about that for a long time now.
So with the new equipment,
Craig, can you talk to the mic, please?
So with new equipment, and the archery's come a long ways.
It has. You still have to get fairly close. There are some that shoot 80 and 100 yards, but a deer can move a little bit by the time your arrow gets there if you're shooting 80 or 100 yards. So I don't think most ethical hunters are shooting that distance. So, most archers I know feel comfortable around 40 yards. And to get within 40 yards to a deer is still a pretty good feat. With their sense of smell and hearing and all these other things that play into it. So it's still difficult, even with the new equipment. Yeah, I have heard of deer being shot at 80 yards or more, but I think those are the exception, not the rule, at least for now. And, that may take off kind of like long-range rifle shooting has and become more of an issue, and then I think we should deal with it at that time.
Any additional discussion? Paul?
Just a comment more from a land management side. As we add a second or a late season hunt on the Wasatch and Nebo units, that doesn't necessarily mean that all the roads are going to be open. So a lot of times we'll close roads before then based on previous decisions that way. So it's more of just a heads up for folks.
Jim, did you have something else?
I'm ready to make a motion.
We have a motion on the table, actually. I think if we're done discussing it, one more, Craig.
Would it be appropriate to put that in the proclamation that there could be road closures? Because there's places where I think
in this
time of year it would be hard.
What Anise and I have talked about is actually adding a statement basically stating that you should check the travel management plan of the land management agency to verify access, which I think is a better way to do it than actually saying, well, this road is closed at this date and this road's closed at this date.
Because oftentimes we don't, we can't know every road that's open and closed.
It's easier just to say check with the landowner or land management agency on travel access.
Don't we already have a statement similar to that?
There is a general statement that, but but we could put them in the specific boundary descriptions as well.
Are some of these roads closed by dates? Microphone. Like there are some roads in
that's correct.
Like there's from September, August 15th, it's closed. So
yeah, there's generally set dates, but some of that also varies with
the weather.
Winter storms.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
We have a motion from Bryce and a second from Lynn to approve the present day, or recommend the Wildlife Board approve the Bucks and Bulls once-in-a-lifetime season dates and application timeline as presented. All in favor? Raise your hand. It's unanimous.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Board.
Thank you. Scott?
I'm not sure how to get out of this.
Just press escape.
Pretty good, eh? No, my brother-in-law is a professional photographer. We were at Chuckerson. I saw this picture. I mean, they're all looking at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I also am not new to this region. I've been here for a little while. I'm the Scott McFarland, the private lands public wildlife coordinator for the state. And tonight I'll be presenting the 2013 Buck and Bull CWMU and Landowner Association recommendations from the division. Can you hear me okay? Okay. What I'm going to do is be going over the applications that for the recommendations for this year for 2013. But to start out, I probably should explain that we receive basically three types of applications. We have new applications, renewal applications, and then change applications, which are basically amendments to the existing management plans that we have for the CWMUs. A new application is basically, if it's brand new, it's obviously it's a new application. It's never been in our state system. Also, if a CWMU has changed land ownership or changed boundaries more than 34%, it falls into that category also. And if they had some CWMUs have taken a year off or 2 years off, and if they do that, if they did not have a certificate of registration for the CWMU in the previous year, then they would have to apply as a new CWMU also. So that's basically the three types of things that we deal with that require RAC and board action. And for this year, for 2013, we had eight new applications. Two were due to land ownership changes I think they were complete change of land ownership. One increased their acreage greater than 34%. Two of them did not have certificates of registration in 2012. And we had three brand new applications in the state. Of those, and then 10 CWMUs required renewal for 2013, and all of those did reapply for the 2013 season. Let's see. I've got to change this here. Four CWMUs in the northern region have moose permit reductions requested by the DWR. Two of these are split recommendations. And we have one discontinued application that was added into an existing CWMU. So based on approval, it would come to a total of 120 CWMUs for the 2013 hunting season. As an overview, we have 120 proposed CWMUs. This is the breakdown by region, and by far the northern region has always had the lion's shares of the CWMUs. The northern region has 71 CWMUs, northeastern 7, central region 13, southeastern region 16, and southern region has 13 CWMUs. Within this program, it's over 2.18 million acres are enrolled in the CWMU program. 97% of that land is private land. There are some public lands included in that. And we have 444 private landowners participating in the CWMU program. Okay, so the 2013 CWMU buck and bull permit recommendations are, for deer, we have 1,983 private permits, 262 public permits. Management deer, and these are in the southern region, we have four private permits, one public permit. Pronghorn, 74 private permits, 53 public permits. And moose, 49 private permits and 31 public permits. For a total of 3,013 private permits and 484 public permits. The public permits constitute about 14% of the total permits. And I will go into the recommendations by region, and we'll start with the northern region. We had three new applications CWMUs in the northern region here. The first one was Strawberry Ridge, and it's classified as a new. It's an existing CWMU that changed because they added more than 34% of the acreage. They added approximately 7,000 acres to the CWMU. And in doing this, they requested more deer, more elk and moose, and pronghorn permits in that process. White's Valley is also a new one. It's a brand new one. It's for deer. And Sage Valley Outfitters is a new one. It's 5,638 acres of deer CWMU. And all three of these, the division recommends approval of them. Renewal applications. These are applications that have come up to the end of their three-year period. CWMUs are approved for 3 years, and at the end of that 3 years, they have the chance to renew them. And these are the ones that came up for renewal in the northern region. Junction Valley. We recommend approval of that. It's a deer and elk CWMU. Rabbit Creek. It's a pronghorn CWMU, recommend approval of that. Pine Canyon, deer CWMU. Wood Canyon, it's a deer CWMU. Bastion Ranch is a renewal. Is it for deer, elk, and moose? They're also requesting, as they have in the past, a variance for a later elk hunt until the 15th of November. And we recommend approval of that. Cotton Thomas is a renewal, and it's deer CWMU, and we recommend approval of all those that were applied for in the northern region. Change applications. A change application is submitted, and anytime either the division or the landowner wishes to change permit numbers, season dates, or the allocation, the permit split, that he needs to go through the RAC and board process. And Park Valley is requesting a change to the deer and pronghorn. They want to add a pronghorn permit and change the deer season dates to go to the, they qualify to go to the November 10th extension on that. Deseret, they added some property, and they also wanted to add deer and elk permits, both public and private, and change the deer season date. Currently, they were ending at October 31st, and they want the November 10th extension on that. They're also requesting an elk variance to the 20th of November, and this was due to their concerns about elk crossing over into Wyoming, the problems we've had with them, possibly mixing with animals coming back, mixing with brucellosis-infected animals particularly, and coming back and infecting our herds. So they requested that variance. Double Cone, it's an elk CWMU. They only requested a bull elk permit split change. They went from a 90-10 to an 85-15, which allows them to have a 25% of the antlerless permits that are allocated for that unit. West Hills requested a deer change. They added approximately 640, about a section of ground to Double Cone. They increased the public permits. They decreased their private permits, but the total number of permits remained at 30 permits on that. Twin Peaks Goose Creek applied for an increase in elk permits. I believe that was just one permit. State Corner asked to change elk permits, increasing bull elk permits. I believe that's they increased it by 10 permits, also adding public permits into there. Hard Scrabble, they wanted to change the split from 85-15 to 90-10 and increase their elk permits also. And the division recommends approval of all these. Okay, and one of the changes, these are division recommended changes. Anytime we have a CWMU that's in a limited entry unit and the limited entry unit decreases their permits, we usually, because of the formula that we use, we decrease the permits on the CWMUs also. We recommend the reduction of those. And the Broadmouth, Bear Spring, South Canyon, and Sharp Mountain all are in the Ogden unit, and there was a pretty significant reduction in permits there, so we also asked for a reduction in permits for these CWMUs. There's a split recommendation on the South Canyon and the Sharp Mountain permits only. And basically what they did is go from all of the CWMUs in this category here, the four CWMUs, are on the second year or the first year of their four-year cycle. So we aren't trying to change permits for this year, but for 2013 and 2014, we asked for a reduction in permits. The South Canyon, the split recommendation on the South Canyon would be is that we drop one private permit for 2013, and 2014 we drop a private permit and also drop one public permit. So, and that's for South Canyon and Sharp Mountain. Okay, the other regions, just really briefly, the Northeastern region had two new applications. One were recommending approval, and one in denying the Circle Bar Ranch due to some boundary issues. It was applied for, and it meets the legal qualifications for a CWMU, but it doesn't really make a good CWMU boundary. It's a very hard to define boundary. They also used 10 acres of residential land to join the two parcels for the CWMU to meet their minimum acreage, and the region did recommend denial of that because of that. Okay, the central region, we had four applications, one new and three renewals. We recommend approval of three of those and to not deny one because of some misrepresentations on acreages and signatures on the application. And that was the Crab Creek CWMU. They recommended denial on. Southeastern region had two applications, one new and one change. The JB Ranch was an existing CWMU that changed ownership. They fell into the category. They changed more than 34% ownership on that, so they needed to apply as a new CWMU. It's also one that was under the minimum of 10,000 acres, so they needed a variance to be able to continue to hunt elk on that. They qualify for deer, but not for elk under that. So basically what we do is we have a process for that. We put it through the division who makes a recommendation. It goes through the CWMU committee who will make a recommendation on that. And then it goes back to the division for a final recommendation. It goes to the RAC and the boards for an approval on the acreage variance. The JB Ranch on this was, we had a majority of the CWMU committee recommended approval of it. The division highly recommended approval of it. It was a CWMU that's worked very good in the past with both deer and elk and provided a good opportunity for hunters for both antlered and antlerless animals. They participated in elk antlerless removal, which was pretty critical to the unit. And so they've recommended to continue that with the variance. And Summit Point wanted to increase elk permits, and we recommend approval of that. Southern region had two applications, one new and one renewal. And it's the same thing on grazing pasture. The ranch sold, same people operate the CWMU, but it's under acreage, and they went through the variance, or requesting to go through the variance process on that. And that has gone through the majority of the CWMU committee and the division recommendation. They recommended approval of this one also. Okay, that concludes it for the CWMU recommendations.
Thank you, Scott. Do we have any questions from the public on Scott's presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions on Scott's presentation? Lynn.
Scott, how often can a CMU change things? Could they change something every year if they needed to, or is it a...
Yeah, they can. What we've built into the process that we can change acreage, they can change, obviously, permit numbers, because our wildlife populations don't stay the same. And so we need to have the ability to adjust the populations up and down to accommodate that with the CWMUs. The things that are required that if they do change it yearly, they have to go through the rack and board process, are permit numbers, season dates, or the permit allocation, basically the splits.
So does that change their four-year cycle when they get it redone?
It doesn't. The only thing that changed their four-year cycle is if they have to reapply as a new CWMU, which if they have greater than a 34% acreage change or land ownership change or something like that, then they have to apply as a new CWMU. Then it starts another three-year cycle.
All right.
Jeffrey.
I see that most of these are a 90-10 ratio. Is that the minimum that they can get away with splitting between private and public?
I don't know if it's the minimum or maximum. Depends on which end you're looking at.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the best split that the CWMU can get is a 90-10 split. They can do that for elk and for deer, bull moose and pronghorn. And buck pronghorn are a 60-40 split, so it's different on those two.
But they could allow more public permits if they wanted to.
If they wanted to,
90-10
yes.
Is the minimum they can get away with.
Right.
Okay.
And what they do is with the 90-10 split, that gives 100% of the antlerless permits that are allocated to the CWMU to the public. If they go to an 85-15 split, then it goes to 25% goes to the CWMU, and 75% go to the public. So it changes as the split changes, and it all has to do with the number that's allocated to the of antlerless permits that are allocated to public and private.
Go ahead.
Okay, another question, different topic. Uh-huh. So on Deseret, they're looking for a variance because they're having brucellosis problems with Wyoming animals. What? Can you explain that?
Well,
is there a boundary that brucellosis doesn't cross?
Well, this has been ongoing for some years. Wyoming has basically expanded their brucellosis positive area and their surveillance area down right close to Utah, in the Sage Creek Junction area, right close to Evanston. And when the winter gets fairly severe, we have an exchange of bulls that keep going across. And at the request of Wyoming and the Deseret people have tried to herd these bulls back so that we don't have that exchange. We're extremely worried about having Utah animals infected with brucellosis. We've tested a lot of animals in the state. We've come up clean so far, but we want to keep it that way. And so that's whether they don't need to hunt that late. They just want to be able to have a few permits to keep the bulls pushed back so they don't have to herd them so often. It's really not to their benefit to have to hunt into November. They really don't need that. It's to correct a problem that we're having. So does that answer that? Yes.
Is there any documentation of what effect brucellosis is having on the elk? I mean, there's a concern from the livestock industry about it spreading to livestock, but I mean, it's rampant in Yellowstone area.
Yeah, well, you're kind of getting out of my realm here, but I can explain a little bit about that. Yeah, there's absolutely a concern. The effect that it has on elk would be the same as it has on livestock. It's an abortion disease.
Right.
You know, it causes economic losses to the livestock industry. And if it does show up, if for example, if Utah loses its brucellosis-free status in their livestock industry, it has multi-million-dollar impacts on us because we don't have the ability to export livestock until it's cleared up. So it has some pretty severe impacts. It's more of a precaution thing right now.
I was just wondering if it had an effect on the elk population.
Yes, it could. So, because it is, it's an abortion disease, and it could have a profound effect on elk production or survival, not production. So,
yeah.
John,
does Sharp Mountain have on the unit? Is it a two ownership, or is it just a one ownership on that? Because I know the west side. I know the boundary's pretty good. It's a combination of two.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'd have to refer to Darren, the district biologist. He's probably more familiar with that than anything.
I think there's a couple, Darren Boyce, district biologist, thanks. I think there's a couple owners in Sharp Mountain. There's one operator, though, for both of those CWMUs. The South Canyon one in Sharp Mountain is the same operator. I think there's four landowners, Jensen's. And I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head, but yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, these, every time, it's the same with landowner associations, and the CWMUs, anything that's in a limited entry permit. The permits, there's a certain number of permits that are allocated for that, and when they take a reduction, we recommend a reduction on the private permits also, which we'll get into in the Landowner Association presentation also.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, we'll go to comments. Do we have any comments from the public? I don't have any blue cards. Okay, we'll go back to the council. Comments from the council and or motions? Jeffrey.
I have a comment. I'm just looking on the change applications for deer and elk, and almost every one of them are increasing private permits, but don't increase the public permits. I'd just like to see us push more towards a more equitable solution for public people. I've had a number of people have discussed the CWMU situations, that they, even people that participate in it, feel like they're not getting a fair shake. I don't know. As I look at this, I see that all these guys all get to add a new private, but none of them are adding new publics. So, just wanted to make that as a comment.
Are those one tag?
Yeah. Like Park Valley gets to add one, but doesn't add for a public, and Deseret adds a few, but only adds a couple publics. Twin Peaks adds another private, but not a public, and just on and on and on. I just hate to see that as a public hunter.
And it could be part of the split. Could you?
Yeah. What happens is, for example, on very low numbers of permits, when they do a 90-10 split, it's hard to split permits in half. For example, if they're adding one permit and they've only got five permits, they're allowed to do that up until 10 permits. And as soon as it reaches 10 permits on a 90-10 split, the 11th permit goes to the public. So it would be a 9-1, and as soon as it goes to 11, it would be 9-2, and then the public or the private can start adding up there up until 20. But the public always gets the first permit as soon as it breaks over that threshold. So it's hard with moose permits, with antelope permits. If you're dealing with very low numbers, there's no true way to get a 90-10 split until they reach that threshold number. So
yeah, I understand what you're saying. It has to tick up to a certain point before the public gets another one.
That's right. And I think that's what most of these have done this year. That as their populations have increased, they've been conservative, added a permit. And until they add permits up to that threshold point, the public will not get another permit.
Okay. At over 2 million acres in the CWMUs and total public permits at 484, you can understand why sometimes people get a little frustrated with the lack of access to our publicly owned animals.
Right. And I guess that all goes back to why initially we started the CWMU program. And it's a matter of private property rights, the public wildlife on private property. And one of the reasons that we did to go into this program was to get some public access onto the private properties that previously had no public access. And one of the another reason was is that we wanted to make sure that the wildlife was valuable to the private landowners and make sure. And so to do that, there has to be some financial incentive. So there is a financial incentive for them. It is also designed to try and keep farming and ranching operations intact, if they could, rather than sell them to subdivisions and things like that. So there's a lot of reasons that we did this. We initiated the CWMU program, and the splits were done right in the onset of the program and have stayed that way. There's a point to where it's not valuable to the landowner, but it's not. Sometimes it appears that it's not equitable to the public also. So that's why we have a public process to address that.
Additional comments and or motions? Ann?
I just have to, abstain from voting for this because I manage a CWMU.
Craig?
I have a question, if you'll entertain it. Do you get harvest totals on these?
Yeah, we do. But the CWMUs turn in the same as any of the limited entry permits. We do get harvest totals, but they're done through, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong here. What the CWMUs have to turn in, like on your once-in-a-lifetime species, the moose and everything, they have tooth packets that they turn in, and there's a harvest reporting requirement for that also, the same as if you applied for a limited entry unit. So yeah, they're not required to turn that in themselves, but the hunters are required to report that harvest. Or they can't put in for the same thing, they can't put in for the limited entry hunts the following year.
So if they have antlerless permits, do they have to harvest those antlerless permits?
In their management plans, we have, to answer your question, yes and no. They have to do that, but in their management plans, what they do is look at it over a three-year period and say that they're going to issue this many tags every year for an individual CWMU, and they have a goal on there that they want to have a minimum harvest of X number of animals based on the ability of the CWMU to harvest those. So, for example, if they had 20 permits a year, they might look at a 50% harvest as a reasonable harvest and hold them to that. That they would harvest 30 elk over the three-year period, and it's more like a goal. I don't think there's any sanctions against them right now for doing that, for not doing that, but they're encouraged to do that, to harvest those animals. There's actually a process where we can go through if it's very blatant, if they're obviously not harvesting the antlerless animals, it can come before the CWMU committee and they would be put on probation until that situation was corrected. And if it still can't be corrected, then they could actually pull the certificate of registration for a year. There are sanctions, but. So does that answer?
Ann has a comment on that.
Yes.
Hey, Scott, I think possibly it would be helpful on the table that you've provided for private and public permits to put antlerless.
Well, this is the bucks and bulls, and so we will do that.
You're right.
Antlerless in the spring. So.
But just as a point of reference, it does help to see those numbers, how many public permits are allowed on CWMUs.
Okay. If that's something that the RAC would like, that's easy to put on there what their antlerless allocation.
Well, just from what some of the things that you guys have been saying, that would be helpful because the numbers flip.
You could put the previous year's numbers.
Well,
you
yeah,
wouldn't know.
They're on a three-year program, it's easy to project that out.
So. John.
That would be helpful because it seems like when we went through the elk management plan for, here a while back, and we talked about the carrying number. Mm-hmm. The big issue was how do we get those females killed with all of the CWMU properties that we have tied up in. So.
Yeah, and it seems that elk harvest is a big issue right now as we're trying to control populations and the fairness of CWMUs taking their share in it also. And if that's something you would like, I can definitely include that in there.
It's just a reference.
Okay. Lynn.
I make a motion that we approve the recommendations that Scott has presented here tonight.
Second.
Jim. If you'd allow me, I'd rephrase it slightly. Recommend the Wildlife Board approve the CWMU management plans and permit numbers for 2013 as presented.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? Jim? Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, say aye. Please raise your hand.
Aye.
Seven, four, opposed? One, with one abstention. Go ahead, Scott. We'll okay. do the landowner.
Okay, we'll move on to the Landowner Association voucher recommendations. And it may be appropriate for me to maybe explain landowner associations if you're not familiar with them. We don't have any in the northern part of the state, in the northern region. They're basically southern region, northeastern region, and central region. And the landowner association is basically in a limited entry unit. A landowner association can form to request permits that are held out for a landowner association in the limited entry unit if they have a 51% simple majority of the private lands within the unit. That's basically the criteria. They can have numerous landowners enrolled in it. They're issued. There's a certain number of the tags that are allocated for the unit that are held out for the landowner association based on acreage and percentage in the unit. And this program was basically to make wildlife valuable on private landowners' property so that they choose to manage for them instead of against them. It was also to mitigate for rangeland damage for animals being on the private properties. And also it allowed the division in certain cases to increase wildlife, the herd unit objectives and increase populations on those certain units. Okay, so the overview for the statewide 2013 landowner applications, we had 14 applications received. That's down one from last year. They're all basically renewals. The DWR recommends approval of the 10 applications as received. And we have four split recommendations on these. Out of the 14 landowner associations, we have 127 deer vouchers, three management buck vouchers, which are down in the southern region again. I think it's on the Elton unit. 77 elk vouchers and seven pronghorn vouchers. Okay, the split recommendations. There's four split recommendations, and these are all in the southern region, and I'll just go over them very briefly. But the Vivant requested seven bull elk permits. They qualified because of the percentage of the land for five permits, and the DWR is recommending five permits. The reason that we asked for the reduction in there is because they had a reduction in the limited entry permits for that unit. The Ponsagant, they requested four management deer. They, because of the formula, they qualified for three of those, and the DWR is recommending three of those. The South Fork of the Sevier River is buck pronghorn. They requested six permits. They qualified for four, and we recommend, the division recommends four. And all those last two are for the same reason, because the limited entry permits were reduced in those units, and so they have a corresponding reduction in the landowner association permits. The Indian Peaks is for bull elk. They requested three permits. They qualified for three permits, and we recommend three permits, but they would like them to be premium permits, which the rule does not allow for. But that was just their request. So, and that concludes the landowner association.
Thank you, Scott. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Any questions from the council? Ann.
Yeah. When you have the landowner disagrees, the landowner association disagrees, what recourse do they have? Do they pursue that, or is what you recommend final? Because I'm fine with that. I just want to know.
Yeah, they can pursue that. They can come and show up at the RAC and the board meetings and plead their case. There might be some mitigating circumstance that you know, we have to, what we have to recommend as a division is what they qualify for legally by law. And so when there's a reduction, what they do is they take the amount of acreage, the percentage of that in the unit, and sometimes the private lands have a higher percentage of habitat in the unit, so they can qualify for another permit. And that might be one of the mitigating circumstances on that. But basically, we have a formula we go through that this is what they qualify for. And they can ask for more, but we have to recommend what they qualify for.
All right. Thank you.
Unless there's certain circumstances. Yes.
So if the RAC were to go along with their requests as a motion, for example, then we'd be asking you to overturn your rules, correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to answer that. Yeah, I guess that's what that means.
Okay.
So, a rule or a guideline, or a procedure, yes.
Well, whichever you want to call
sure.
it. You're the person who knows the words, not
right,
us.
Right, right. So. And I believe that when they do the permit allocation, it's in rule, but it's also procedure. It's spelled out very specifically how we allocate those permits to the units. So.
Any additional questions? Jeffrey.
I have a question as to how the Landowner Association determines what they request. Do they just throw a pie in the sky and just hope for the best, or do they have an idea of what you're looking for?
I think the reason that these are requested, because that's the number that they had the previous year, and as the permits for the unit decreased, they still wanted to have the number of permits they had the previous year. And I imagine that applies to all three of those. That's what they had the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody likes to take a cut in permit, public or private.
John.
So.
I think it's a really good thing that we're able to give ranchers and landowners an opportunity to be able to stay on their land, and this is definitely one way to do it. My question is, and you know, maybe it's how many of these permits do they use, or do they sell them all, or?
Some of the landowner associations distribute them around amongst their members. Some of them are sold. Any income that is derived from these, a lot of landowners have got into this because they've had wildlife damages on agricultural fields and things, and a lot of this is to mitigate for those damages because of the income that they derive personally from that is deducted from a damage payment. And a lot of times these guys, because they've been able to derive an income, have just foregone the damage payments because of it, because all of a sudden they do have a benefit to having that wildlife on their properties. So
it's good.
Paul.
Are the landowner associations informed that they have the opportunity to come and talk in front of the RAC if they feel like they want the additional permits? Is that part of the education that they
go through? That's a requirement. We do inform them that it is a split recommendation, and I imagine in the southern region they'll have a representative at the southern region RAC, because these are all southern region landowner associations to present their case there.
I'm just wondering if they realize that all the RACs see that, not just the southern.
I think when the board makes a decision on that, they realize that they aren't going to go to all the RACs and plead their case to them. So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Jeffrey.
Okay, this one might be a silly question, and I probably should know this, but on the landowner association, they're different from the CWMUs.
Right.
If they got five permits, are they obligated to give anything to the public at all?
They aren't obligated. They can by rule, unless they have a variance from it, they have to allow a certain, I'm kind of cloudy on this, but I think they have to allow a certain number of the other permits, the other limited entry permits onto that property, unless they have a variance to that.
And they're able, South Fork gets their four permits, they can do whatever they want, they can sell them, they can give them away, they can do whatever they please.
Whoever they want that qualifies to have that permit. But a lot of them do sell them because it's a revenue source for the association, and then some of them do a portion of it and then have draws for members of their association, so they get these permits. They're highly coveted permits, most of them.
I imagine they're worth a lot of money.
Some of them are.
Any additional questions? John?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we approve the...
We need to go a little bit farther because we're on questions right
we're
now.
We're still on questions?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So
sorry about that.
Let me get through the rest of the procedure and then we'll do it.
Okay.
Then you're on.
Then I'm on.
Any more questions from the council? Seeing none. Do we have any comments from the public? I don't have any blue cards. Do you want to comment on this? Be sure to give me that blue card and we'll put that agenda on. Go ahead.
Is there...
give me your name, though.
Oh, it's Paul Roberts.
Yeah.
Any incentives potential or planned on for enhanced vegetation management to draw or create more wildlife opportunities instead of growing cheat grass? Do they get more if they put something that the deer and elk can feed on?
You want me to respond?
Yeah, I believe they're... Go ahead.
Okay. There's not an incentive for them to do that other than to enhance the wildlife on their property. Normally when somebody... Are you talking about landowner associations or CWMUs or both? In their management plan, we do have sections in there that what things that they're going to do to improve the habitat. It's not something that's mandatory, but we like them to think about it, whether they do water developments, reseed projects, controlled burns, whatever. But we have a portion in there. Most of the... Well, all the CWMUs at least do put something on there that says that, you know, we want to work on water burning, you know, something to enhance it for wildlife. And a lot of times it benefits the livestock also. But they don't get any additional permits or anything for doing that. Their reward for doing that is increasing the wildlife population and then possibly being able to eligible for more permits because the population has increased. Right. It's definitely designed to make wildlife valuable on the private properties to the private property owners.
So. Okay. We'll now go to comments from the council. I don't see any comments, John. If you
now I'll make a motion. I would move that we forward a approval recommendation to the Wildlife Board on the Landowner Association recommendations presented.
I'll second.
I have a second from Russ. So we have a motion from John Blazard and a second from Russ to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the landowner permit numbers for 2013. Acceptable? Any discussion on the motion?
Just a point of order that what we were going to vote on is the recommendations by the DWR, not the permits requested.
Correct.
Right.
Any discussion on the motion? Additional discussion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand. Say aye.
Aye.
Eight, four. Opposed? One. And I just procedurally, I forgot to ask you if you would give your reason or share your reason for opposition so the Wildlife Board could
For both the CMWMU and this one, I just can't in good conscience vote for anything that doesn't give more opportunity to the public. I don't think there's enough of it.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you, Scott.
Okay.
Thank you. Any additional business the council would like to discuss? Seeing none, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn.
Second.
Be quicker than
that. Thank you, everyone.
We have an opposing vote.